Chapter 38. When I was a child listening to Grandam's endless parade of verses, one short piece I demanded to hear over and over started. Some say the world will end in fire, some say in ice. Grandam did not know the name of the poet. She thought it might be by a pre-Hegira poet named Frost, but even at my young age I thought that was too cute to be true for a poem about fire and ice. But the idea of the world ending in either fire or ice had long stayed with me, as enduring as the sing-song rhythm of the simple verse. My world seemed to be ending in ice. It was dark beneath the ice wall, and too cold for me to find adequate words to describe. I had been burned before. Once a gas stove had exploded on a barge going upriver on the Khans, and gave me slight but painful burns over my arms and chest, so I knew the intensity of fire. This cold seemed that intense. Sort of slow-motion flames cutting my flesh to shreds. The rope was secured under my arms, and the powerful current soon whirled me around, so I was being dragged feet first down the black chute, my hands raised to keep my face from bashing against inverted ridges of rock-hard ice, my chest and underarms constrained by the tight rope, as Abedic acted as a brake by staying on belay. My knees were soon torn by razor-sharp ice as the current kept throwing my body higher, striking the uneven ceiling of passing ice like someone being dragged across rocky ground. I had worn socks with the ice more in mind than the cold, but they did little to protect my feet as I banged into the ice ridges. I was also wearing undershorts and undershirt, but they provided no buffer against the needles of cold. Around my neck was the band of the comm unit, the mic patches pressed against my throat for voice or sub-vocal transmission, the hear plug in place. Over my shoulder, and tightly secured with tape, was the waterproof bag with the plastique, detonators, cord, and two flares I had put in at the last moment. Taped to my wrist was my little flashlight laser, its narrow beam cutting through the black water and bouncing off ice, but illuminating little. I had used the laser sparingly since the labyrinth on Hyperion. The hand lamps were more useful in wide beam and required less charge. The laser was largely useless as a cutting weapon, but should serve to bore holes in ice for the plastique. If I lived long enough to bore holes. The only method behind my madness of allowing myself to be swept away down this subterranean river had been a bit of knowledge from my home guard training on the ice shelf of the continent Ursus. There, on the Bear Paw Glacial Sea, where the ice froze and refroze almost daily through the brief Antarctic summer, the risk of breaking through the thin surface ice had been very high. We had been trained that even if we were swept away beneath the thickest ice, there was always a thin layer of air between the sea and icy ceiling. We were to rise to that brief layer, set our snouts into it, even if it meant that the rest of our faces had to stay submerged, and move along the ice until we came to a break or thin enough patch that we could smash our way out. That had been the theory. My only actual test of it had been as a member of a search party fanning out to hunt for a scarab driver who had stepped out of his vehicle, broken through not 2 meters from where the ice supported the weight of his 4-ton machine, and disappeared. I was the one who found him, almost 600 meters from the scarab and safe ice. He had used the breathing technique. His nose was still pressed tight against the too thick ice when I found him, but his mouth was open underwater. His face was as white as the snow that blew across the glacier, and his eyes were frozen as solid as steel bearings. I tried not to think of this as I fought my way to the surface against the current, tugged on the rope to signal Abedic to stop me, and scraped my face against shards of ice to find air. There were several centimeters of space between water and ice, more where fissures ran up into the glacier of frozen atmosphere like inverted crevasses. I gasped the cold air into my lungs, shined the flashlight laser into the crevasses, and then moved the red beam back and forward along the narrow tunnel of ice.
"Going to rest a minute," I gasped. "I'm okay. How far have I come?"
"About 8 meters," whispered A. Bettig's voice in my ear.
"Shit," I muttered,
forgetting that the comm would send the sub-vocal. It had seemed like 20 or 30 meters at least.
"All right," I said aloud. "I'm going to set the first charge here."
My fingers were still flexible enough to trigger the flashlight laser to high intensity and burn out a small niche into the side of the fissure. I had pre-molded the plastique, and now I worked it, shaped it, and vectored it. The material was a shaped explosive. That is, the blast would discharge itself in precisely the directions I wanted, provided that my preparations were correct. In this case, I had done most of the work ahead of time, knowing that I wanted the blast directed upward and back toward the ice wall behind me. Now I aimed precise tendrils of that explosive force, the same technology that allowed a plasma bolt to cut through steel plate like hot bolts dropped into butter, would send these plasma tendrils lancing back through the incredible mass of the ice behind me. It should cut the 8-meter section of ice wall into chunks and drop them into the river very nicely. We were counting on the fact that the atmosphere generators through the years of terraforming had added enough nitrogen and CO2 to the atmosphere to keep the explosion from turning into one massive blast of burning oxygen. Because I knew exactly where I wanted to aim the force of the blast, the shaping of the charges took less than 45 seconds and required little dexterity. Still, I was shaking and almost numb by the time the tiny detonator squibs were set in place. Since I knew the comm units had no trouble penetrating this amount of ice, I set the detonators to the preset code and ignored the wire in my bag.
"Okay,"
I gasped, settling lower in the water.
"Let out the slack."
The wild ride began again, the current pulling me lower into blackness and then battering me against the crystal ceiling. Then the wild search for air, the gasped commands, the struggle to see and work while the last warmth drained from me. The ice continued for another 30 meters, right at the outer limits of what I thought the plastique could handle. I set the charges in 2 more places, another fissure and the last bundle in a narrow tube I burned into solid ceiling ice. My hands were totally numb during the last placement. It was as if I were wearing thick gloves of ice, but I directed the charges up and downstream in roughly the proper vectors. If there were not an end to this ice wall soon, all this would be in vain. A. Bettig and I had anticipated chopping away at some ice with the axe, but we could not hack our way through many meters of the stuff. At 41 meters, I burst up and out into air again. At first, I was afraid it was merely another crevasse. But when I aimed the flashlight laser, the red beam flicked through a chamber longer and wider than the one where I had left the raft. We had discussed it and decided that we would not blow the explosives if I could see the end of any second chamber. But when I lowered the beam down the length of the Black River here, illuminating the same mist and stalactites, I could see that the river, about 30 meters wide at that point, curved out of sight several 100 meters downstream. There were no more riverbanks or visible tunnels here than there had been in our earlier stretch of river, but at least the river appeared to keep running. I wanted to see what the river did once it rounded the turn, but I had neither the rope nor body heat I needed to float that far, report, and get back alive.
"Pull me back,"
I gasped. For the next 2 minutes I hung on, or tried to hang on. My hands no longer worked, as the android hauled me back against that terrible current, stopping occasionally as I floated on my back and gasped in the frigid air of the crevasses. Then the black ride would begin again. If A. Bettig had been in the water and I had been pulling, or even if it had been the child, I could not have pulled either of them back through that heavy current in 4 times the time it took A. Bettig. I knew that he was strong, but no Superman. No miraculous android strength. But he showed superhuman strength that day. I could only guess at the reservoirs of energy he used to pull me back to the raft so quickly. I helped as best I could, slashing my hands by pulling myself along the icy ceiling and fending off sharper crystals, kicking weakly against the current. When my head broke the surface again, seeing the haloed lantern light and the shapes of my two companions leaning toward me, I did not have the strength to lift my arms or to help pull myself onto the raft. Abedic seized me under the arms and lifted me gently out. Anea grabbed my dripping legs, and they carried me toward the stern of the raft. I admit that my dulled brain was reminded of the Catholic church we stopped by occasionally in the North Moor village of Latmos, the little town where we picked up our food and simple shepherd supplies, and of one of the large religious paintings on the south wall of that church, Christ being taken off the cross, one of his disciples' arms under his limp arms, his bare and mutilated feet being held by the Virgin. "Don't flatter yourself," came the unbidden thought through my mental fog. It spoke in Aenea's voice. They carried me to the frost-laden tent, where the thermal blanket was ready on a pile of two sleeping bags and a thin mat. The heating cube glowed next to this nest. Abedic stripped me of my sodden undershirt, flare bag, and comm unit. He untaped the flashlight laser, set it carefully in my pack, laid me firmly within the top sleeping bag with the thermal blanket around me, and opened a med pack. Setting sticky biomonitor contacts against my chest, the inside of my thigh, my left wrist, and temple, he looked at the readouts a moment, and then injected me with one ampule of adrenonitrotoline as we had planned. "You must be getting tired of pulling me out of the water," I wanted to say, but my jaws and tongue and vocal apparatus would not oblige. I was so cold that I was not even shivering. Consciousness was a slender thread connecting me to the light, and it wavered in the cold wind that blew through me. Abedic leaned closer. "Emendymion, the charges are set?" I managed a nod. It was all I could do, and it seemed that I was operating a clumsy marionette to do that. Anea dropped to her knees next to me. To Abedic, she said, "I'll watch him. You get us out of here." The android left the tent to push us away from the ice wall and to pole us upstream, using the push-pole from that end of the raft. After the expenditure of energy it had taken to drag me back against the current, I could not believe he could find the strength to move the entire raft the necessary distance upriver. We began moving. I could see the lantern glow on the mist and distant ceiling through the triangular opening at the end of the tent. The fog and icy stalactites moved slowly across the tiny reference triangle, as though I were peering through an isosceles hole in reality at the ninth circle of Dante's hell. Anea was watching the simple med-pack monitors. "Rawl, Rawl," she whispered. The thermal blanket held in all the heat I was producing, but I felt as if I were not producing any body heat. My bones ached with the chill, but my frozen nerve ends did not convey the pain. I was very, very sleepy. Anea shook me awake. "You stay with me, damn it." "I'll try," I thought at her. I knew I was lying. All I wanted to do was sleep. "Abedic," cried the child. And I was vaguely aware of the android entering the tent and consulting the med pack. Their words were a distant humming that no longer made sense to me. I was far, far away when I dimly sensed a body next to me. Abedic had gone away to pole our ice-laden raft upstream against bitter current. The child Anea had crawled under the thermal blanket and edge of the sleeping bag with me. At first, the heat of her skinny body did not penetrate the layers of permafrost that now lay in me. But I was aware of her breathing, of the angular intrusion of her elbows and knees in the tented space with me. "No, no," I thought in her direction. "I'm the protector here, the strong one hired to save you." The cold sleepiness did not allow me to speak aloud. I do not remember if she put her arms around me. I know that I was no more responsive than a frozen log, no more receptive to company than one of the icy stalactites that moved across my triangular field of vision, its underside lighted by the lantern's glow, its top lost in darkness and mist, much as was my mind. Eventually, I began to feel some of the warmth her small body poured out. The heat was dimly perceived, but my skin began to prickle with needles of pain, where the warmth flowed from her skin to mine. I wished I could speak just to tell her to move away, so that I could doze in nerveless peace. Some time later, it might have been 15 minutes or 2 hours, Abedic returned to the tent. I was conscious enough to realize that he must have followed our plan, anchoring the raft with lodged push-poles and steering oar somewhere in the narrowing upper part of the ice cave, under the visible segment of Farcaster portal. Our theory had been that the metal arch might protect us from avalanche and icefall when the charges went off. "Blow the charges," I wanted to say to him. Instead of keying the comband, however, the android stripped to his tropical yellow short pants and shirt, then crawled under the thermal blanket with the girl and me. This should have been comical. It may sound comical to you as you read this. But nothing in my life had moved me as deeply as this act, this sharing of warmth by my two traveling companions. Not even their brave and foolhardy rescue of me in the violet sea had touched me so deeply. The three of us lay there. Aenea on my left, her left arm around me. Abedic on my right, his body curled against the cold that crept in under the corner of the thermal blanket. In a few minutes, I would be weeping from the pain that came from returning circulation, from the agony of thawing flesh. But at this moment, I wept at the intimate gift of their warmth as life's heat flowed from both child and blue-skinned man, flowed from their blood and flesh to mine. I weep now in the telling of it. How long we stayed that way, I cannot say. I never asked the two of them, and they never spoke of it. It must have been at least an hour. It felt like a lifetime of warmth and pain and the overpowering joy of life's return. Eventually, I began trembling, then shaking slightly, and then shaking violently as if possessed by seizures. My friends held me then, not allowing me to escape from the warmth. I believe that Aenea was also weeping by that point, although I have never asked, and in later days she never spoke of it. Finally, after the pain and palsy had largely passed, Abedic slipped out from under our common cover, consulted the medpack, and spoke to the child in a language I once again could comprehend. "All within the green," he said softly. "No permanent frostbite, no permanent damage." Shortly after that, Aenea slipped out of the blanket and helped me sit up, putting two of the hoar-frosted packs behind my back and head. She set water to boiling over the glowing cube, made mugs of steaming tea, and held one to my lips. I could move my hands by then, even flex my fingers, but the pain there was too great to grasp anything successfully. "Emendymion," said Abedic, crouching just outside the tent. "I am prepared to transmit the detonation code." I nodded. "There may be falling debris, sir," he added. I nodded again. We had discussed the risk of that. The shaped charges should shatter just the ice walls ahead of us. But the resulting seismic vibrations through the ice might well bring the entire glacier of frozen atmosphere down around us, driving the raft to the shallow bottom and entombing us there. We had judged it worth the risk. Now I glanced up at the frost-rimmed interior of the micro-tent and smiled at the thought that this would give us any shelter. I nodded a third time, urging him to go ahead. The sound of the blast was more subdued than I expected, much less noisy than the concomitant tumble of ice blocks and stalactites and the wild surging of the river itself. For a second, I thought that we were going to be lifted and crushed against the cave ceiling as wave after wave of pressure-propelled and ice-displaced river water surged under the raft. We huddled on our little stone hearth, trying to stay out of the frigid water, and riding the bucking logs like passengers on a storm-tossed life dinghy. Eventually, the surging and rumbling calmed itself. The violent maneuvers had snapped our steering oar, flung one of the push poles away, dislodged us from our safe haven, and floated us downstream to the ice wall. To where the ice wall used to be. The charges had done their job much as we had planned. The cavern it had created was low and jagged, but after probing it with the flashlight laser, it appeared to go through to the open channel beyond. Aenea cheered. Abetic patted me on the back. I am ashamed to admit that I may have wept again. It was not so easy a victory as it first seemed. Fallen ice blocks and surviving columns of ice still blocked parts of the passage. And even after the initial rush of ice into the breach slowed a bit, it meant heavy going with the surviving push-pole and frequent pauses as Abedic hacked away at icy obstacles with the axe. Half an hour into this effort, I staggered to the front of our battered raft and gestured that it was my turn with the axe. "Are you sure, Emendymion?" asked the blue-skinned man. "Quite sure," I said carefully, forcing my cold tongue and jaw to enunciate properly. The work with the axe soon warmed me to the point that the last of the shaking stopped. I could feel the terrible bruises and scrapes where the ice ceiling had battered me. But I would deal with those pains later. Finally, we hacked our way through the last bars of ice to float into the open current. The three of us pounded sock mittens together for a moment, but then retreated to huddle near the heating cube and to play the hand lamps on either side as new scenery floated by. The new scenery was identical to the old. Vertical walls of ice on either side. Stalactites threatening to drop on us at any moment, the rushing black water. "Maybe it will stay open all the way to the next arch," said Aenea, and the fog of her breath remained in the air like a promise. We all stood up as the raft swept around the bend in the ice-buried river. For a moment it was confusion as Abedic used the pole and I the shattered stub of the steering oar to fend us off the port-side ice wall. Then we were in the central current again and picking up speed. "Oh," said the girl, from where she stood at the front of the raft. Her tone told us everything. The river went another 60 meters or so, narrowed, and ended at a second ice wall. It was Aenea's idea to send the comlog bracelet ahead as a scout. "It has the video microbead," she said. "But we have no monitor," I pointed out, "and it can't send the video feed to the ship." Aenea was shaking her head. "No, but the comlog itself can see. It can tell us what it sees." "Yes," I said, finally understanding. "But is it smart enough without the ship AI behind it to understand what it sees?" "Shall we ask it?" said Abedic, who had retrieved the bracelet from my pack. We reactivated the thing and asked it. It assured us in that almost arrogant ship's voice that it was quite capable of processing its visual data and relaying its analysis to us via the comband. It also assured us that although it could not float and had not learned to swim, it was completely waterproof. Aenea used the flashlight laser to cut off the end of one of the logs, pounded nails and pivot bolt rings to hold the bracelet in place around it, and added a hook ring for the climbing rope. She used a double half hitch to secure the line. "We should have used this for the first ice wall," I said. She smiled. Her cap was rimmed with frost. Actual icicles hung on the short brim.
"The bracelet might have had some trouble setting the charges," she said.
I realized as she spoke that the child was very weary. "Good luck," I said idiotically, as we tossed the braceleted log into the river. The comm log had the good grace not to respond. It was swept under the ice wall almost immediately. We brought the heating cube forward and crouched near it as Abedic let out the line. I turned up the volume of the comm unit speakers, and none of us said a word as the line snaked out and the tinny voice of the comm log reported back.
10 meters.
Crevasses above, but none wider than 6 centimeters, no end to the ice.
20 meters, ice continues.
50 meters, ice.
75 meters, no end in sight.
100 meters, ice.
The comm log was at the end of its tether. We spliced on our last length of climbing rope.
150 meters, ice.
180 meters, ice.
200 meters, ice.
We were out of rope and out of hope. I began hauling in the comm log, even though my hands were sensate and awkwardly functional now. It was difficult for me to haul the essentially weightless bracelet back upstream. So vicious was the current and heavy the ice-laden rope. Once again, I had difficulty imagining the effort Abedic had put forth in saving me. The line was almost too stiff to curl. We had to chip away the ice from around the comm log when it was finally hauled aboard.
"Although the cold depletes my power unit, and the ice covers my visual pickups," chirped the bracelet, "I am willing and able to continue the exploration."
"No, thank you," Abedic said politely, turning off the device and returning it to me. The metal was too cold to handle, even with my sock mittens on. I dropped the bangle into the frosted backpack. "We wouldn't have had enough plastique for 50 meters of ice," I said. My voice was absolutely calm, even the shivering had stopped. And I realized that it was because of the absolute unblinking clarity of the death sentence that had just descended upon us. There was, I realize now, another reason for that oasis of calm amid the desert of pain and hopelessness there. It was the warmth. The remembered warmth. The flow of life from those two people to me, my acceptance of it, the sacred communion sense of it. Now, in the lanterned darkness, we went ahead with the urgent business of attempting to stay alive, discussing impossible options, such as using the plasma rifle to blast a way through, discarding impossible options and discussing more of the same. But all the while, in that cold, dark pit of confusion and rising hopelessness, the core of warmth that had been breathed back into me from these two friends kept me calm, even as their human proximity had kept me alive. In the difficult times to come, and even now as I write this, even while expecting death's stealthy arrival by cyanide on every breath I take, that memory of shared warmth, that first total sharing of vitality, keeps me calm and steady through the storm of human fears. We decided to pole the raft back the length of the new channel, seeking some overlooked crevasse or niche or air shaft. It seemed hopeless, but perhaps a shade less hopeless than leaving the raft pressed up against this terminal icefall. We found it right below where the river had made its dogleg to the right. Evidently, we had all been too busy fending off the ice walls and regaining the center current to notice the narrow rift in the jagged ice along what had been our starboard side. Although we were searching diligently, we would not have discovered the narrow opening without the tight beam of the flashlight laser. Our lantern light, twisted by crystal facet and hanging ice, passed right over it. Common sense told us that this was just another folding in the ice, a horizontal equivalent of the vertical crevasses I had found in the ice ceiling, a breathing space leading nowhere. Our need for hope prayed that that common sense was wrong. The opening, fold, whatever, was less than a meter wide and opened onto air almost 2 meters above the river's surface. Poling closer, we could see by laser light that either the opening ended or its narrowing corridor bent out of sight less than 3 meters in. Common sense told us that it was the end of the icy cul-de-sac. Once again, we ignored common sense. While Anea leaned into the long pole, straining to hold the raft in place against the churning water, Abedic boosted me up. I used the claw end of our hammer as a climbing tool, chipping it deep into the ice floor of the narrow defile and pulling myself up by speed and desperation. Once up there on my hands and knees, panting and weak, I caught my breath, stood, and waved down to the others. They would wait for my report. The narrow ice tunnel bent sharply to the right. I aimed the flashlight laser down this second corridor with rising hope. Another ice wall reflected back the red beam, but this time there did not seem to be a bend in the tunnel. No, wait. As I moved down the second corridor, stooping low as the ice ceiling lowered, I realized that the tunnel rose steeply just beyond this point. The light had been shining on the floor of the icy ramp. Depth perception did not exist here. Squeezing through the tight space, I crawled on all fours for a dozen meters, boots scrabbling on the jagged ice. I thought of the shop in echoing, empty New Jerusalem, where I had bought those boots, leaving my hospital slippers behind and a handful of Hyperion scrip on the counter, and tried to remember if there had been any ice crampons for sale in the camping section there. Too late now. At one point, I had to slither on my belly, once again sure that the corridor was going to end within a meter. But this time it turned sharply to the left and ran straight and level, deep into the ice, for 20 more meters or so before angling right and climbing again. Panting, shaking with excitement, I jogged, slid, and claw-hammered my way back downhill to the opening. The laser beam cast back countless reflections of my excited expression from the clear ice. Anea and Abedic had begun packing necessary equipment as soon as I had disappeared from sight. The girl had already been boosted to the ice niche and was setting aside gear as Abedic tossed it up. We shouted instructions and suggestions to one another. Everything seemed necessary. Sleeping bags, thermal blanket, the folded tent, which could be compressed to only a third of its former tiny size due to the ice and frost on it. Heating cube, food, inertial compass, weapons, hand lamps. In the end, we had most of the raft's gear on the landing. We argued some more, the exercise and hot air of it keeping us warm for a minute, then chose just what was necessary and what could fit in our packs and shoulder bags. I carried the pistol on my belt and lashed the plasma rifle on my pack. Abedic agreed to carry the shotgun, its ammunition topping off his already bulging pack. Luckily, the packs were empty of clothes. We were wearing everything we owned, so we loaded up on food packs and gear. Anea and the android kept the comm units. I slid the still icy comm log onto my bulky wrist. Despite the precaution, we had no intention of losing sight of one another. I was worried about the raft drifting away. The lodged push pole and shattered steering oar would not hold it for long. But Abedic solved that in a moment by rigging bow and stern lines, melting niches in the ice wall with the flashlight laser, and tying the lines around solid ice cleats. Before we started up the narrow ice corridor, I took a final look at our faithful raft, doubtful that we would ever see it again. It was a pathetic sight. The stone hearth was still in place, but the steering oar was in splinters. Our lantern mast in the bow had been broken and splinted. The leading edges had been bashed about, and the logs on either sides were all but splintered. The stern was awash, and the entire vessel was filmed with ice and half hidden by the icy vapors that swirled around us. I nodded my gratitude and farewell to the sad wreck, turned, and led the way to the right and up, pushing the heavy pack and bulging shoulder bag ahead of me during the lowest and narrowest bit. I had feared that the corridor would run to an end a few meters beyond where I had explored, but 30 minutes of climbing, crawling, sliding, and outright scrambling led to more tunnels, more turns, and always climbing. Even though the exertion kept us alive, if not actually warm, each of us could feel the invasive cold making gains on us. Sooner or later, exhaustion would claim us, and we would have to stop, set our rolled mats and sleeping bags out, and see if we would awaken after sleeping in such cold. But not yet. Passing chocolate bars back, pausing to thaw the ice in one of our canteens by passing the laser beam across it at its widest setting, I said, "Not much farther now."
"Not much farther to what?"
asked Anea from beneath her crest of frost and ice.
"We can't be near the surface yet. We haven't climbed that far."
"Not much farther to something interesting," I said. As soon as I spoke, the vapor from my breath froze to the front of my jacket and the stubble on my chin. I knew that my eyebrows were dripping ice.
"Interesting,"
repeated the girl, sounding dubious. I understood. So far, interesting had done its best to get us killed. An hour later, we had paused to heat some food over the cube, which had to be rigged carefully so it would not melt its way through the ice floor while heating our pot of stew, and I was consulting my inertial compass to get some idea of how far we had come and how high we'd climbed, when A. Bedick said,
"Quiet!"
All three of us seemed to be holding our breath for minutes. Finally, Anea whispered,
"What? I don't hear anything."
It was a miracle that we could hear each other when we shouted. Our heads were so wrapped about with makeshift scarves and balaclavas. A. Bedick frowned and held his finger to his lips for silence. After a moment, he whispered,
"Footsteps. And they're coming this way."